Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Hurricane season may be over, but piles of wood, carpet, shingles, and appliances remain lining the edges up and down the overseas highway in the Florida Keys. Almost 3 months after Hurricane Irma and the remains of homes and businesses and lives before the storm are still stark reminders today that while much of the mainland has returned to normal, the wounds from Irma are still fresh in the Keys.
This is going to be a very long process. I mean, we're talking years to completely rebuild, and we're going to see a lot of change in our community in the meantime.
That's Monroe County Commissioner Heather Carruthers. While she and fellow commissioners this week agreed to borrow $40 million to help pay for the cleanup, money it hopes to get back from the federal government, bigger decisions about how to rebuild remain, namely, will mobile homes come back to the Keys? And if so, under what conditions?
We don't yet understand the extent of the damage to the mobile homes and how many of them we've had, you know, and they are not necessarily up to code. They're not safe places to live, but they're affordable.
Affordability and resiliency. Can they coexist in the Florida Keys? What are the stakes for residents in Monroe County and the residents in South Florida? If you live or play or work in the Keys, how do you want to see the Keys rebuild after Hurricane Irma? 800-743-WLRN. Phones are open now. 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet. Look for us on Twitter. At WLRN is our handle. Nancy Klinginer is our southernmost reporter with us from our studios at the studios of Key West. Alex Harris covers climate change for our partner, the Miami Herald. Nan, let's begin with you in Key West. What's the status of the debris cleanup today here as we're close to the three-month anniversary of Irma?
The state of Florida has agreed to come back and do one more pass along US 1, and the county has sent out a notice just yesterday saying, do not add any more along US 1. So I think there's hope that those very obvious debris piles may soon be going away. But the fact is, in the neighborhoods of the Lower Keys, people are still living with the remains of their lives in their homes every day.
The debris that lines the overseas highway is debris that has been brought there from those homes in large cases, because it is the one and only artery in and out, of course, of the Keys. This one last pass by the state, is it going to pick up everything, or is it just organic matter? Is it just the downed trees and the palm fronds and those kinds of things?
It's going to pick up everything that FEMA allows to be picked up. So that would include more than debris, but not vehicles, not mobile homes, not some of the larger pieces of wreckage that we're still seeing out there.
Not boats, right. Not boat motors. What about appliances?
I'm not sure about that. I know those do go in a separate category, but I don't know for sure whether those are included in this latest DOT pass.
As this cleanup kind of continues on, what about the action of the county commissioners this week in terms of paying for the cleanup? The Federal Emergency Management Agency has money for all of these communities, but it's money that takes 12 months or longer to wind up back in the communities that spend it immediately after the storm.
Right. That's why they approved going out for that loan. They're hoping they may not even need to use it, that they may get a faster reimbursement. But they know that there are still some counties upstate that are waiting for Matthew reimbursement. And they have money in reserves, but they don't want those reserves to be empty heading into the next hurricane season, which is only 6 months away.
Oh, thanks for reminding us here on December 1st, Nancy. Appreciate that. Alex Harris, covering climate change for our partner, the Miami Herald. You've been up and down Overseas Highway recently. You've seen these debris piles as well. It is that stark reminder that while life and property, for the most part, has gotten kind of back to normal in the mainland, it is still a significant scar on the lives of thousands of Floridians in the Lower Keys, especially, isn't it?
Absolutely. And anyone I talk to who is down there are getting fed up with seeing those piles on the side of the street, seeing in their neighborhood, having to swerve when they drive down their streets. In fact, the other day I saw on a Facebook post about the Keys is someone hung Christmas lights on one of the debris piles.
I actually saw those lights when I was driving home from the meeting on Wednesday.
Did you know it was key? Was it obvious it was lights on a debris pile?
Yes, it absolutely was.
Yeah, but there's some real danger in these debris piles 3 months after the fact. There's some real health damage, health danger. There's wildlife. These things can be real magnets for a lot of problems that can stick around for for, you know, days, weeks after those debris piles perhaps get picked up eventually, right?
Absolutely. One of the men I talked to yesterday who spoke up at the committee meeting, who also was in Nan's story, mentioned that he is a 9/11 firefighter and he's dealing with lung impacts based on his experience there. And now he lives in Big Pine and he's got a 7-foot-tall, 20-foot-wide pile of debris in front of his house. And he says it's made the air hard to breathe. He has to use his inhaler more than he ever has before.
Debris piles still a fact of life, especially in the lower Keys, but even beyond the lower Keys, middle Keys and upper Keys, you still see a lot of evidence of Hurricane Irma almost 3 months ago. Talking about it here with Alex Harris, climate change reporter for the Miami Herald, Nancy Klinger, our southernmost reporter at the studios of Key West with us at the end of the road down there. Nan, let's talk about the real tough decisions that the county has to make regarding housing. I know you've talked with a lot of residents. We've heard from a lot of residents as well about the decisions that the county needs to make relatively soon because the damage that was wrought on more than 7,000 mobile homes, the ability to kind of rebuild after that, and the importance of the residents who rely on those kind of homes to fill the jobs in the Keys as you're moving into economically one of the most important seasons, if not the most important season for that region.
Right. Our major tourism season is generally between Christmas and Easter, but it's already going. Certainly, it's pretty busy down here in Key West already. And the thing with mobile homes is you can replace a mobile home in extremely limited zoning districts that are, I think it's urban residential mobile home districts. Otherwise, you're looking at coming up to code because that's what the federal government requires if your community wants to be eligible for flood insurance. So people are looking at replacing homes with something that's more expensive. And it's not just mobile homes. It's also homes that predated those federal flood requirements from the 70s that were on the ground level. Those also have to come up to code and be elevated. So the county's looking at finding more modular units that are small, you know, the sort of tiny home, maybe 500 to 700 square feet, that are relatively affordable, but also much stronger than a mobile home that can stand 180 mile an hour winds, that have impact glass and metal roofs.
Alex, what are the options that commissioners have in the timeline that they're running on here as we move into that heavy tourism season and the season for high employment in Monroe County?
So what we heard from commissioners yesterday is right now there's not much they can do for people who are in that situation. They're really relying on FEMA to bring the trailers in and to provide funds to help people afford hotel rooms or vouchers for rent. But there really isn't these grants they're looking at and this extra money they're trying to find won't be available until maybe January, February, maybe not until next summer. So right this minute, not so much.
They were able, I believe the county was able to get FEMA to cough up more money for those housing vouchers. Nan, correct me if I'm wrong, because, you know, the cost of hotels in Monroe County is the highest average daily rate of any county in the state. And so those FEMA reimbursement levels didn't go so far until the county, I think, was able to get a few more dollars from FEMA. Is that right?
They did. They actually tripled their typical reimbursement rate because our hotel rooms are expensive and also because we just don't have the land to set up a sort of a temporary trailer park where people could live. They are looking at a couple of sites in the Keys. The former Big Pine Key Road Prison is actually one of them. But there aren't. We just don't have those kinds of tracts of land where you could park trailers and give them utilities and other infrastructure while people are rebuilding.
So are we talking about trailers and mobile homes temporarily while the county and the commissioners, Alex and Nan, kind of figure out whether or not mobile homes as traditionally welcomed in Monroe County will be allowed back in a more permanent basis?
I would say yes, but they already know where mobile homes could be allowed back. And like I said, that's in very, very limited
right.
zoning areas. Right. And otherwise, they're going to be looking at how to help people come up to code.
And so, Alex, when they look at that, what are they considering? What are the considerations?
Well, the floodplain zones is a big deal. What we heard yesterday is if you have more than 50% damage in one of your mobile homes and you don't meet a couple other loopholes, you basically have to rebuild to code, which could mean an elevation of about 3 feet, could mean an elevation of much higher. And what we heard yesterday is that the majority of the trailer parks where this damage happened are in floodplain zones where they have to rebuild to higher standards. And people are worried they don't have the money for it. They may get their checks from FEMA, they may get their insurance money, but these grants that the commission is looking into would possibly provide gap funding to help people be able to not just rebuild to where they were, but to be rebuilt to a more resilient status.
Future of mobile homes in Monroe County post Hurricane Irma. We're talking about it with Alex Harris. That was her you just heard, a climate change reporter for the Miami Herald. Nancy Klingener is with us from our southernmost bureau at the studios of Key West. You can join us at 800-743-WLRN all throughout South Florida, 800-743-9576. Let's go to Big Pine Key where Debbie is on the line. Debbie, thank you for holding on. Yes. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I've got a lot of thoughts, and I'm going to try to keep them concise. I'm a bartender at the main local tavern in Big Pine Key, so I kind of have the pulse of the community. We are in a collective state of trauma and shock. The devastation has just begun. People have nowhere to live. You've got 500 to 600 families in Big Pine Key that when, you know, their hotel vouchers run out this week, they have nowhere to go. Landlords are doubling their rents for no reason because they can. I mean, I go to college. There are at least 3 college students I know of that are living in their vehicles. Hmm. I mean, Key West looks great, and we want our tourists back. But Big Pine is in tough shape.
Yeah, it is. And you're right. You've got the ear of the community there on the other side of the bar, no doubt about it, Debbie. What about you? I mean, what are those? What are the steps that you, your family are taking over the next 3 or 6 months?
There's nothing available. I'm going to be homeless myself probably in about a month. I won't go into details of it, but yeah. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to rent. Unless you have like $7,000 cash first month, last month in security, you're not going anywhere. You know, and I don't have $7,000. So where does a working family go?
Yeah.
All the trailers blew down. That's where the poor people live. And the poor people are not going to be allowed to rebuild. So people are leaving. The exodus is incredible.
Are you sticking around, Big Pine?
Yeah, I thought about leaving, but no, I'm in for the fight.
For the fight, Debbie.
I'm in for the fight.
we wish you well. We're glad to hear from you, though, and I know we'll stay in contact. Thanks so much for giving us a ring.
Thank
we appreciate
you,
it to hear Robert, that perspective.
Thanks for bringing this up.
Yep, absolutely. Nan, your thoughts when you hear Debbie? I mean, that story you've heard often when you go, especially in that lower Keys, the Big Pine, some of the Torch Keys. But even up in Marathon and in those areas, this is kind of the bedrock community, the workforce housing, the hospitality worker, the teachers, the law enforcement folks. These are you know the year rounders in the Florida Keys, not the town and gown type crowd.
Right. Yeah, I mean, people are living in cars. People are living in tents if they happen to, you know, own their property or have a long-term lease but can't live in the structure that was on there. I mean, it is dire in the Lower Keys. And also, some folks in Isla Mirada are still struggling, too.
And so, Alex, the encouragement of development here, the county has a real housing crisis right now, but it also has a resiliency challenge of trying to put in place or enforce really the rules that you talk about, the floodplain rebuilding rules, the FEMA rebuilding rules, some of the insurance rebuilding rules that have been on the books for a good long time, but have either been ignored after past hurricanes. And Nan, you can speak to this as well. Is there a political fortitude this time around, Nan, to follow through with the rules that are on the books regarding rebuilding in these locations?
I think there is political fortitude, which is just driven by the realities of participating in the federal flood insurance program. You know, if people in the Keys want flood insurance, then the county has to enforce these rules. And we've seen hurricanes here before. You know, Wilma was a pretty good flood here in the Lower Keys, especially. Hurricane George in 1998 hit the Lower Keys pretty hard with wind. But nothing like this, nothing that's really wiped out thousands of homes.
And so, Alex, how are they going to encourage this kind of development, this kind of resiliency?
Yesterday, the commission made some moves to create a special little 2-year to change the rules for 2 years for workplace housing. Mm-hmm. They tried to speed it up a little bit, maybe by changing the time that you'd have some meetings. This is just an idea they're tossing around. They haven't come to a full agreement on it, but this looks like one of the ways that they would try to convince developers to come build low income, very low income, maybe a little bit of moderate income housing in a place that really doesn't have a lot of space for it. And if you're a developer and you can make a lot of money with a high income house in Key West, it's hard. You need a lot of incentive to create an affordable workplace housing area anywhere else.
It is a thin vein of coral rock that is the Florida Keys, Nan. So, and there isn't a lot of development, and that development is regulated very, very tightly. And so when you see 7,000, 7,200, 7,500 mobile homes and RVs, real core housing, get damaged like they were during Hurricane Irma, what kind of development constraints are put on that kind of rebuilding effort that that the Keys are going to have to undertake?
Right. We have very, very strict building limits in the Keys, imposed mostly by the state of Florida because we are an area of critical state concern. And we are allowed a total of, I think, 350-something new units every year. And that runs out in 2023. And we are purportedly on the books going to be at build-out at that point. And there will be no new development allowed in the Keys. At the county commission meeting, they were talking about, for unincorporated Monroe, they have a total of 571, you know, affordable units they will be allowed to build ever in perpetuity. And they want to encourage the building of those as quickly as possible. But even these changes that they were talking about this week couldn't even take effect for a year. So yeah, it's a very, very regulated, strict process to build anything. Ask anyone who's ever tried to build anything in the Keys. And that's what they're up against. I'm sure from a mainland perspective, it sounds pretty silly. But when you're talking about 100 units and adding more cars to our one and only road, and you can really change the character of a relatively small community. So it's a tough balance for the Keys, for sure.
And we even heard the mayor say yesterday, maybe we need more Keys.
Right.
Need more Keys. Anon is joining us here on WLRN from Big Pine Key. Anon, thanks for holding on. Your thoughts?
Good afternoon. I'm just wondering, has anybody thought about solutions to this crisis that is currently happening and seems to be ongoing for the next, many years?
Yes, we talked about a number of solutions. It could be tiny homes, modular homes, those kinds of things. But I think that what we've heard, Nan from the county commission and Alex from the county commission, is the series of options in front of them are not immediate solutions by any stretch of the imagination, are frankly expensive solutions and solutions that really threaten to some degree the long term fabric of the Florida Keys. That's the challenge. Anon, what about on Big Pine Key and your experience here post Irma?
I came here on day 10, and since then I've been watching the slow destruction of various. Either Irma did it, or the wreckers are coming in, and they're taking down lots of mobile homes. Now, the solution that I can suggest is a concrete house, which is cheap enough for people to afford and be able to, have some sort of a FEMA-assisted SBA mortgage so that they can live on $500 a month if they own their lot.
If they own the lot, right. So let's tackle that idea here and put it to Alex and Nan. It's an interesting idea because, Nan, I think we've got kind of two rebuilding challenges. There's the challenge of rebuilding higher to get it out of the floodplain and the storm surge. And then there's the challenge of rebuilding it stronger against the windstorm threat of hurricane force winds.
Right. And FEMA does have some grant programs that should be available to us. We don't know exactly when. And the county is looking to apply for every single one of those. And we heard about all kinds of options yesterday, including, say, you had a ground level concrete house that flooded. Mm-hmm. You could essentially turn that into the foundation for an elevated house. And, of course, other kinds of elevated houses. These modular small homes are probably the most affordable option. But there's all kinds of options, including buying out properties who are in floodplain areas and have seen repeated impacts.
How likely is that, Alex? Did you get a sense of the temperature of the county and these repetitive loss properties? This is a hot, politically a dangerous item for a number of communities that really rely on the National Flood Insurance Program to help underwrite mortgages in those areas. Dade County, Broward County, Florida has more national flood insurance policies than any other state in the country, and these repetitive losses of homes that are flooded, you know, every few years, two times, three times, four times, begins to be a significant cost on this program.
Right. And what we heard yesterday was that some of the ideas they've considered, like Nan just said, is buying up some of these very, very vulnerable areas and returning them to nature. And we saw some examples of other communities that have done that, but it's all voluntary. They can't, you know, eminent domain those houses. So that might not work if you can't get everyone to agree, because the last person there, unless you hold the flood insurance stick over their head,
yeah,
it's hard to get compliance.
What about the incubator nature of the Florida Keys as the canary that's furthest in the coal mine of climate change here in the state of Florida, and kind of how this community responds to Irma and figures out a way to rebuild that is environmentally resilient and economically sustainable.
Right. And Florida obviously is the state most vulnerable to climate change. So in Miami especially, we look to the Keys and we see what they do, and they see how they handle affordable workplace housing, how they handle resilience, which are obviously issues we deal with as well. The idea of stilt houses, the idea of modular homes that you could move back away from floodwaters, is something that is actually being considered even higher north. I heard recently that Highland Villages in North Miami Beach has been bandying around the idea of possibly building stilt houses, possibly building tiny homes. It's something that we all keep a close eye on. It hasn't affected us as much as it affects them right now, but we look to the future.
Nan, how about it from your perspective down at Key West?
Yeah, we are always the canary in the coal mine, or we're sort of the distilled essence of South Florida.
Yeah.
Everything that Florida eventually is confronting happens here first, in terms of water supply, climate change, affordable housing, all that kind of stuff. And I would say that, yeah, we are a good place to be an incubator for that, but we are also going to rely very heavily on the state and federal governments for help with that, because we have been under these state and federal strictures on growth and development.
One more quick call here. JD is calling from Fort Lauderdale in Broward County. JD, thanks for holding. You're on the radio.
Yes, this is JD from Fort Lauderdale. There's a little nonprofit company, and I think that what they produce and sell is exactly perfect to meet the need in Monroe County. The website is ephot.info. Now, that's like Disney's Epcot, but it's with an H instead of a C.
JD, the phone line's a little rough here on your mobile, but what's the product?
The low-cost modular-type housing that,
yeah,
is solar-powered with atmospheric water generation from $20,000 up. It's built for that price.
All right. So noted. I'm sure it's something that...
ephot.info.
Got it. Thank you, JD. Thank you very much. Nan, I want to talk about that point just real quick, not necessarily about JD's idea here, but this idea of the cost of rebuilding. You heard it from Anand in Big Pine Key. You just heard it from JD talking about this could, you know, here's this product that you can rebuild for $20,000 or $50,000 or $60,000. You're still putting that in a local economy in Monroe County that is dependent upon tourist and hospitality type jobs, that, you know, the median income in Monroe County is slightly higher than the rest of Florida, but that's only an average. So, you know, putting those costs into that community means what?
Well, it means we're going to have to get creative on how we expect people to afford to live here if they're working in a service economy. I mean, the county commission, the school district, the sheriff's office, they're all talking about starting to provide housing for their employees. Some folks are saying some of the bigger tourism properties need to step up and start doing that too. And we've heard examples of land trusts. There was somebody at the county commission meeting that said they are starting a Florida Keys community land trust. They want to build Keys cottages, sort of modeled on the Katrina cottages that were built in New Orleans after that storm. And they said they have $1 million in seed money to start, and they want to start putting these on scattered sites around the Keys. So it's not going to be a pure market-based economy for that. They're going to need some help.
Nancy Klinginer, our southernmost reporter, with us from our studios, inside the studios of Key West. Alex Harris, climate change reporter for a part of the Miami Herald, with us in our downtown Miami studios. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us on the roundup today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for having us.
Still to come, gun owners, listen up. How secure are your firearms? Guns stolen from cars, it's been on the increase in South Florida. So how do you keep your gun safe? You can join us, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, as the roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks, as always, for listening to public radio. There are almost 2 million gun licenses in the state of Florida. Now, figuring out how many guns are in the state, that's a lot more difficult. This state, like most, does not require gun owners to register their weapons. A new investigation finds a jump in recent years of guns stolen from cars and trucks in South Florida, and these guns can find their way into the hands of criminals. The report comes from NBC6 and journalism nonprofit The Trace.
In the illegal firearms trade, most of the guns that would be stolen would end up in the hands of criminals. There are community guns that criminal organizations share firearms amongst themselves.
That was Ari Shapiro, Assistant Special Agent in Charge of the Miami Division of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, speaking with NBC6. If you own a gun, how do you keep it safe? 800-743-WLRN. You can join us here on the Roundup at 800-743-9576. Tony Pepitone is the investigative reporter for NBC6 South Florida behind this report. Tony, welcome to WLRN. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What struck you as you dug into trying to get a handle on stolen guns? What difficulty did you encounter, and what's the takeaway?
What we tried to do was to take a very large view. We got thousands of records from police agencies listing the serial numbers of guns that were stolen, and then we got the serial numbers of guns that were recovered at crime scenes. And when we did a match, we found a lot. We found a lot of guns. In fact, nationwide, The Trace was able to find more than 20,000 firearms that had been recovered by police over a five-year period that were stolen. About 1,500 of them, I think it was, were serious crimes, carjackings, murders, rapes, wow. Some very serious crimes. Locally, what we did was looked at a few departments that we could get the data from. And what struck me, I think, was that the way these guns are being stolen is changing, and it may be changing because people are more conscious of the dangers of firearms in the home, but unfortunately, they're leaving them in their cars.
Yeah, what you found is right. Vehicular theft of these firearms, I want to talk about that in a moment, but back to kind of tracing a stolen gun. The difficulty here is, as I mentioned, Florida, like most states, doesn't require a legal gun owner to register a serial number or a weapon that this is their weapon. So when it gets stolen, you may not have any record of it.
That's true. When it's used at a crime scene, police right. may not be able to get a record of it.
It may be the first time that weapon shows up for law enforcement.
What the agencies have to do and have access to is the ATF data that shows where a gun was purchased originally. When that first sale is made from a licensed firearm dealer, there is a record of that. It's a paper record. It's stored in a warehouse in West Virginia. Congress will not allow them to digitize the records to make a search of the data.
Wow.
They are scanning the documents, but there are trailers in the back, like loading, you know, like ship carrier trailers that have these documents in them, and they have to manually sort them to try to find where this gun is. But that just gets you to the starting point, where it was sold originally. Then it could have been sold again, which doesn't have to be registered. It could have been stolen, could have been bartered, borrowed, anything.
So, stolen guns in South Florida, 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number. Tony Pepitone along with us, investigative reporter for NBC6 South Florida. He partnered with the nonprofit journalism group The Trace, looking at stolen guns here in South Florida. And you looked at Miami and Fort Lauderdale in terms of these firearms being stolen from cars and trucks. What'd you find out?
You know, over the five-year period, the percentage of the number of cars, enough firearms stolen from cars was up 120% in Fort Lauderdale. And that just really was among the largest increases we found across the country. Miami was a little more toward the middle, about up 80%.
What kind of numbers are you talking about? How many guns does that represent, that kind of increase?
I don't have that number with me.
All right, we'll take a look at it and see if we can find it. But still, a triple-digit percentage increase, a 100% increase in the stolen guns.
Yeah, 120% in Fort Lauderdale. I just don't remember the raw numbers. But there were hundreds. We're talking hundreds.
And is that a statistic that law enforcement has tracked for many years?
Anecdotally, when we talk to law enforcement, they say, we know this is happening, you know, and we tried to get the education out that you need to keep your gun in a secure place. But people don't get the message, including sometimes law enforcement doesn't get the message. We found a case where a Miami-Dade police officer had his weapon stolen from his marked vehicle, which was outside a house in Southwest Dade, just in August.
Yeah. And so this idea of, you know, trying to protect your home from your firearm by putting it in your car may make it that much more vulnerable for criminal elements. Let's go to the phones here. A few calls in Miami. Robert, we'll start with you on line two. Thanks for holding on, Robert. What's your experience here?
Hi. I work in the city of Miami, and I work in really bad areas. So one of the things I was worried about was when I purchased my gun and I was going to carry it on was what happens if, you know, I'm at work and they break into my car. So one of the things I looked up right away was to see if there's anything out on the market or to keep it safe in my car. And what I found was that they have a special custom vault, so to speak, that they custom make it to your car, and it sits inside the center console. And basically, you either have a key access or a combination lock, and it's pretty hard. It's pretty heavy duty, box in order to get into it. So they would have a pretty hard time. They'd have to get maybe like drills and power tools to try to get into it. So that was one of the first things I thought about, and I have now, and I've had it for years. And I show it to anybody that carries their gun in their car that it's a must because, you know, God forbid that gun falls into the wrong hands and it's, you know, involved in a crime.
Robert, I appreciate you telling your story to us here on WLRN. Could you share with us why you feel the need to have your firearm in your vehicle?
I'm a firefighter and I work in very bad areas. And I've had many stories of fellow firefighters, witnessing or either being involved in an armed robbery where they were there to see things happen. And, you know, just to have peace of mind, I always want to have something on me just because, you know, God forbid, you know, I'm here to help people. That's what I do for a living. And God forbid I'm involved in a situation where I'm helpless. It's just, part of my nature, I think.
Yeah.
So,
and, you know, there's been a rash of burglaries from outside fire stations where people...
Yes.
Yeah, where they realize that these firefighters have weapons.
Have weapons, yeah. So
one of our stations, they broke into like 9 or 10 cars in the middle of the night, and a lot of the guys had guns and they weren't secured. So who knows? You know, I don't know exact number of how many were stolen, but you know, there's no shame. You know, they've actually called in emergencies just to get all the firefighters out of the station in order for them to break into the station. Mm-hmm.
Unreal.
Wow. Robert, thanks for sharing your perspective with us. We appreciate it. You can join us here, 800-743-WLRN, talking about stolen guns out of vehicles in South Florida. Tony Pepitone, the investigative reporter for NBC6 South Florida, looking into this in our region. Tony, we put this call out to our social media audience, got a few responses here about, you know, how secure is your firearm if you're a gun owner. One response, take your NRA sticker off your car. My car was broken into 4 times until I realized I was advertising the presence of a gun with the National Rifle Association. Alex is with us on line 3 from Miami. Alex, thanks for hanging on. What are your thoughts here?
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to first point out an error with your guest's previous statement in regards to tracing stolen guns. The way that tracing would work would generally be the gun found at a scene would have the serial number traced. They call up the manufacturer of that gun, so Glock, for example. Mm-hmm. Glock is then able to tell them which dealer it was sent to. The dealer has those records, those 4473s, and then from there you're able to find the original purchaser. You don't typically have to go through the thousands upon thousands of ATF documents. You can normally just go straight to the original dealer from the manufacturer. But besides that, yes, you have an issue where that only gets you to the original purchaser.
Right.
The ones in West Virginia are firearms places that have shut down or forwarded the records.
Gotcha. So if you purchased a gun at a licensed dealer that's no longer in operation, they send those files to those cargo areas in Virginia.
That's
gotcha.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
But
yes, Alex,
that's correct.
Great. Wonderful.
And
you want to talk about the prohibited places
for guns?
Go ahead.
I carry a firearm daily. I have invested plenty of my own time and my own money into getting training so that I feel confident with the firearm so that I'm not just carrying a tool that could potentially harm myself as much as anybody. And within Florida law, Chapter 790, there's a list of places where those with a concealed weapon license can't carry. This includes schools, colleges, polling places, sporting events, and I think about six or seven others, including courthouses. So as a law-abiding citizen, I carry as often as I can and to every place that I legally can, which means that I'm not carrying if I'm going into a Florida Panthers game, for example.
Sure, or the courthouse and something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
So I'm then forced to leave a gun in my car. This is problematic in a couple senses because, first off, the statistics show that concealed weapon license holders in Florida are more law-abiding than even the police officers in this state. Now, what this says to me is a couple things. First off, this list of prohibited places needs to be looked at. Like, there's no reason why a law-abiding citizen shouldn't be allowed to carry into a polling place.
So, Alex, your thought here is, in order to cut down on stolen firearms from vehicles, let's reduce the number of locations where concealed weapons are prohibited from, like college campuses, like sporting events, like polling places, for instance. That's your assessment here.
That's my assessment. If you have a smaller list of places where concealed carriers like myself can't carry, then their firearms are going to be on them and very much harder to be stolen than in their car.
They won't be left behind.
How do you secure it in your car, and what advice would you give to others to keep it secure in your car when you have to leave it in your car?
I agree with Robert, the previous caller, completely. They make plenty of safes that you can bolt into your car, whether in the trunk, on the passenger floor, in your console. Some Jeep models can be fitted with safes that go under the driver's seat.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, my car doesn't take that particular model, but there are plenty of safes that you can bolt into your car. And I agree with the social media commenters. Like, don't put NRA stickers, Glock stickers on your car. Criminals aren't quite that dumb. They know exactly what that means, and they know that they have a higher probability of getting a gun if they break into the car.
Alex, we appreciate your perspective. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I want to go to Florida City, where Edward has been hanging on. Edward, thank you for your patience. Your thoughts on guns and cars?
Hello?
Edward, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I was dual certified, as they call it. I went through the police academy and I went through the fire academy. I carried my fire bunker gear in the trunk. My home was broken into. I was in police law enforcement 25 years. Everything on the door is metal. They had to use tire irons and crowbars. Unfortunately, I'm right next to the police station where all their cars are parked, where they come and go when they go by my... Everything was ignored. It was a massive burglary. My home was destroyed. But the point is, over the years, from other officers, as they either left the law enforcement, whatever, I picked up, bought their... I had over 15 handguns and semi-automatic rifles stolen out of my home.
Wow. Did you have any precautions taken for those guns?
Inside my home, no. I kept them hidden, not in normal places. Mm-hmm. That's why my home was so massively trashed.
Yeah.
There wasn't a piece of furniture or a drawer and its contents in this entire house. It's a three bedroom that was not dismantled, turned over, and destroyed.
Well, those guns are probably out on the streets.
Yeah, Edward, do you know if those guns have ever shown up?
One was recovered in North Miami, or North Miami Beach, by a federal unit. That has been returned to me.
Yeah.
But none of the up, they're all floating on the street,
and
I know what happens.
Yep.
There are so many bad guys.
Edward, we got it. We appreciate you sharing your story. We're glad you're okay, despite the property damage and obviously the thievery of those firearms there. Edward from Florida City. Tony, you talk about in the report kind of looked at that market of guns, kind of how that cycle happens.
Well, yeah. I mean, people who can't legally get a gun, there's going to be a market for them, and that's going to be on the street. And for instance, there was a Pompano Beach drug trafficking organization that ATF went after, and they actually had sold, over the course of a little more than a year, 285 firearms illegally. Many of them, unfortunately for them, went to an ATF agent. And about 40 of them were confirmed to be stolen. So this Operation Clean House was able to get those guns off the street, but you know, there are so many, and that's it's reached a point now where it's saturation.
When you talk with law enforcement, Tony, what's the sense of engagement on stolen guns? Or is it just, you know, like crime, it's a fact of life?
Especially with juveniles, it turns out that those one of our reporters went out with a multi-agency gang task force, and they deal often with juveniles who, of course, can't legally possess and buy guns. Firearms, handguns. And they say they know that they are going through parking lots, they are burglarizing cars, they are burglarizing houses, and that's especially where this is a problem, because young people with a gun, you know, who have ill intent, it's not going to end well.
Tony Pepitone, investigative reporter for NBC6 South Florida. Tony, great to have you on the program. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you.
Still to come on our program, Interstate 95. It runs Miami to Maine, the deadliest stretch right here in South Florida. So is it how we drive or is it the road? How do we stay safe on the internet? 800 on the internet, on the interstate for that matter. 800-743-WLRN. That's next. We're back on the roundup here. I'm Tom Hudson on WLRN. Thanks again for listening. To our fellow South Floridian drivers, we curse it. To others, we brag or we warn them about it. Interstate 95. The pavement runs almost 2,000 miles from Maine before unceremoniously ending just south of downtown Miami. There's a simple sign there telling white-knuckle drivers 95 ends. It either marks the end or the beginning of the deadliest stretch of the highway, according to a new analysis by the Wall Street Journal. It found in 2015 there were 14 fatal crashes on I-95 in Dade County, more than any of the almost 100 counties the road runs through on its way up to Maine. So is it how we drive? Is it how much we drive? Is it the design of the road, and how can it just become safer for us here in South Florida? 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number. James Wolf is with us now, the Florida Department of Transportation's District 6 Secretary. James, that means you are responsible at FDOT for this stretch of I-95, the deadliest stretch in 2015 by the number of fatalities. Your response to that kind of statistic is what?
I don't want to focus on the deadliest stretch because while we don't agree with the way that that conclusion was arrived at, to argue against that designation is to say that we're satisfied with the safety condition of the road. Any number of fatalities is too much. But in the industry, we calculate fatalities per million vehicle miles traveled.
Yeah. This is just a gross number, just the sheer number of fatalities per county.
Right.
It wasn't. It wasn't based upon the number of cars driving here versus driving I-95 in
South Carolina.
In South Carolina, right, or Martin County for that matter. Sure.
Yeah, we have 12 lanes. They're congested. They have 275,000 vehicles a day on the roads in Miami. But let's get past the statistics, or whether it is the most dangerous.
Well, yeah,
it is a place where you have to be alert as a driver. You have to follow the rules. You have to drive defensively, or are there going to be problems out there?
So is it the way we drive? Is it the design of 95 somehow, with the narrow shoulders, with the express lanes, with the signage, with the dips and divots, with the kind of spaghetti swirls the local lanes do up in the Golden Glades? Is it the design? Is that part of this?
I'd say everything you mentioned is part of it. But when I travel, I go to Tallahassee every month, and I'm always struck when I drive the rental car and the local traffic. They do not drive like people from South Florida. And I think it's because we're always in a rush down here. We're not going as fast as we want. We can't pick our own speed. There's traffic congestion. So people push, and they lose their patience. And frankly, that's no way to drive. You need to drive safely.
Well, you're talking about there as an engineer, or social engineering, right? Not civil engineering in this case.
A lot of it is social engineering. Almost all collisions, including fatalities, are the result of driver error. That doesn't mean that we can't do something with the design of our roadways to make them as safe as possible, but the biggest component is what the drivers do when they're on that road.
Let me focus on the engineering side. If you could redesign 95 in Dade County today, and I know you can't, but let's wipe the blueprint clean, what would it look like?
Oh, it'd probably look like I-595. And the difference there is they have express lanes that have 12-foot lanes, full shoulders, barrier walls that divide them from the other lanes, and the other lanes are all 12 feet wide, and they have great ramps at the interchanges that braid over each other. They're called braided ramps. A lot of those features we do not have on I-95 in Miami, and we would love to have them. Within the space we have available and the geometric constraints that we have, we do the best with the road that we can.
Let's take a couple of quick calls. Everybody's got an opinion on I-95. You hear it all the time, certainly. Let's begin with Matt in Fort Lauderdale. Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, how are you guys doing today? Thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to point out that I travel extensively and work in Europe, so I find myself on the autobahns in Germany and on the major freeways throughout Holland and France. One thing I can say for sure is that the condition of our roads is definitely less than what it is in Europe. And the primary factor, I think, that drives the congestion and the problems in South Florida is literally not following the rules. In Europe, you have to take hours and hours of instruction before you could even get your driver's license, and people are held to a standard. There's plenty of law enforcement on the roads over here. If you look around at the cars, it's not that there are not enough police officers to enforce the rules. People just don't care. You see far fewer police cars on the roads in Europe than you do here. And the driving is such a pleasure. I'm always shocked when I land back in Miami and get on the road to come home after traveling around Europe for a couple of weeks.
Matt, we appreciate that perspective. And I'll let you and James Wolf know with the Florida Department of Transportation, who's our guest here on the roundup. We did tried to contact folks with the Florida Highway Patrol because law enforcement is an issue. What are your thoughts about the enforcement of the traffic laws? If we talk about kind of social engineering and some of the driver mistakes that you've identified and Matt has experienced, we've all experienced out there, and probably we're all somewhat guilty of it as well.
When we look at safety on 95 or any roadway, and we look at the tools available to us to fix that, sometimes we talk about the four E's, and that's engineering. We can engineer the roads better. We can enforce them. That's the second E. We can get patrolmen out there that if you're not doing the right thing, you're going to be reminded with a very expensive ticket. We have emergency services, and if there is a collision, we want to get all those people out there and deal with it promptly. And the fourth E is education. People need to know what the right thing to do is, and then they need to do it. And frankly, I think enforcement is one of the stronger pieces of education that we have.
One of the challenges of 95, though, and we've documented this on WLRN, is the narrow shoulders on I-95 don't allow, frankly, for a real safe pullover by FHP or any law enforcement agency for that matter.
That's a great question. A year ago, we rolled out a plan that said we were going to look at the express lanes and do something better. And by the end of the calendar year 2016, we had replaced all of the 3-foot-tall pylons mm-hmm. with stronger ones, 5 feet rather than 10 feet. And we have 7 months of after data. And that after data says we're not replacing very many of those. People aren't going over them.
They're not lane hopping as much.
They call it lane diving down here. Yeah. I think we're unique in the country in calling that. But lane diving, the tickets are down 88% since the beginning of the year. And the collisions in the express lanes are down 30%. One element of our program, so we're really thrilled with that. One element of our program we haven't done yet, and you may see construction in the median next to the express lanes. What we're doing is we had narrow shoulders on both sides of the barrier wall, 8 feet.
Yep.
Let's make it really narrow on one side, 4 feet, and the other side will be 13 feet. And we do that for about 1,000 feet. And we alternate it
gotcha.
So that you can limp into a wide shoulder.
We got to leave it there. James Wolf is with us, the Florida Department of Transportation's District 6 Secretary here on the Roundup. Thanks, James.